This week on Your Western Context, a very special episode where we look at the history of conservatism in Western Canada, specifically the rise of social credit policy in BC, Alberta, and a Western-based Conservative Party of Canada. This is Western Context, episode 121, A History of Western Canadian Conservatism. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are in this week, and this week we do have a bit of a special as we are taking a bit of a Western Context spring vacation, and this week we're going to be talking about something different than we normally do in terms of Canadian media. Normally here at Western Context, most of our focus is on the news and the news of the week and cutting through all the bias and sensationalism that we see. But if you're joining us for the first time, that's what we normally do. This is a bit of a departure from our regular shows. On this two-week break that we're taking, we have two specials for you. Obviously, the last one that we had was on the history of the Liberal Party, and our second special today is going to be on the history of Western Canadian conservatism.
Yes, that's right. We're going to talk about how conservatism kind of broadened its appeal in Alberta, BC, as well as federally, and we'll be going over all of the movements, all of the political organization that had happened in those different provinces, and as we see that heading towards today.
Indeed, and you know, we're actually going to start this one with the probably what most people see as the most conservative part of Canada, and that's right here in Alberta. And we're going to start with this all the way back in 1935 and the Social Credit Party. And the Social Credit Party was a party that was founded shortly before the election of 1935. Prior to that, we had the United Farmers Association, a precursor to the NDP here in power in Alberta. And in 1935, the United Farmers were thrown out. They lost all of their seats in the Social Credit, took power, and ran the province until 1971. And this was originally born out of a movement that ended up dealing with the Great Depression. The party's goal was to first and foremost implement social credit monetary policy, and this aimed to equalize wealth by providing prosperity certificates to the population that some were ultimately dubbed as funny money. And this was in large part here, the Social Credit Party, a rural-based populist party with strong social conservative values, here in Alberta at least. As I mentioned, the party was formed months before it won the 1935 election in a landslide. The party won 54% of the vote and 56 out of 63 seats. The party was run and led by William Eberhardt, otherwise known as Bible Bill Eberhardt, until 1943 when he died. The party brought in a lot of social restrictions here in Alberta, most notably when flying over the province, you would not be able to serve alcohol. That was one of them. And the party actually also instituted the Alberta Eugenics Program. The party was also known for establishing the only provincially owned bank in Canada, the Alberta Treasury Branch, and it's now known as ATB Financial, and it's still owned by the province today in 2019. Ernest Manning took over the party and led it until 1968 and oversaw what was a transformation of the party from a party that was focused around implementing social credit monetary policy to what ultimately turned into a fiscal conservative party when Alberta discovered oil in 1948 and started to make money off of the oil royalties. The party won its last election in 1967 before Ernest Manning, retired. And everybody will know that Manning is a very important name here in political circles in Alberta. Now, following the Social Credit Party, we had the rise of the Progressive Conservatives, and this was the true Progressive Conservative era under both Peter Lougheed and Don Getty. Peter Lougheed contested the 1967 election against Ernest Manning and only won six seats, which at the time wasn't even enough to even think of forming government. In 1971, Lougheed won with the simple slogan of "Now," representing the desire for more representation for the growing urban centers of Edmonton and Calgary. It was very much a case at the time of the two biggest cities in the province wanting more say into provincial affairs, as prior to the 1967, the 1967 election, the Social Credit was a rural-based party, and the rural wing effectively dominated provincial politics since the founding of the province in 1905. And, you know, the rest would be history, starting with the win in 1971, gaining 49 out of 75 seats, and this set off the second longest political dynasty in Canada, of course, only running until 2015, when the Progressive Conservatives were defeated by the NDP. Peter Lougheed also oversaw the further development of Alberta's oil sector and fought against Pierre Trudeau's national energy program. He also set up the Alberta Heritage Savings Trust Fund, which was designed to save for the future of Albertans. Money is still being put into the trust fund today, and as of December 2018, the value of the assets in the fund were worth $17.6 billion, invested in a variety of industries and portfolios. Lougheed served until 1985, when Don Getty won the Progressive Conservative leadership, and Getty's premiership saw the budget deficit increase. He also targeted struggling sectors with government spending, and on this front, it's why the NDP in this past provincial election often said they were running a campaign similar to that of Peter Lougheed or Don Getty, and that they employed the same policies of offering tax cuts or rebates to businesses or sectors that were in need of financial help. Getty was also responsible for pushing Senate reform at the Meech Lake Accord when the Canadian Constitution was being talked about, and when it became clear that there would be no Senate reform, he introduced the Alberta Senatorial Selection Act, which Alberta used until it expired in 2017 under the NDP government, to create a list of potential senators in waiting that should be appointed to Canada's upper chamber, of course the Senate. And the UCP government aims to bring this back for the 2024 election. And one interesting thing about this is that even though since the 1980s, Albertans were electing senators, it wasn't until Stephen Harper became prime minister that a federal government actually pulled names from this list of senators in waiting that were elected in Alberta. Don Getty also made news headlines for fighting against Brian Mulroney on implementing the GST in Alberta, but was ultimately unsuccessful. And this is, of course, the difference between two different styles of progressive conservative governments, one here in Alberta and one at the federal level. Don Getty served until 1992, and the duo of Peter Lougheed and Don Getty ultimately defined what can be known as Alberta progressive conservatism. Following Don Getty's resignation, Ralph Klein was elected as leader of the Progressive Conservatives, and this marked a dramatic shift for the party, in which he promised a fiscal platform that was very similar to which the United Conservative Party ran on this past spring. He promised to get spending under control, eliminate the deficit, and would ultimately go on to eliminate Alberta's debt, making it the only region in North America without a sub-sovereign debt. He also achieved these spending reductions through cutbacks and reduced the size of government in the process of doing so. And he is also known for, or sometimes criticized for, the Alberta Prosperity Bonus, which was a $1.4 billion handout in 2005, giving $400 to every single Albertan. And this included those under the age of 18 who would receive the checks and their parents could cash them. And of course, the homeless also received these checks. And the government made sure to work with various homeless shelters to ensure that those who are at those shelters would be able to access this $400 check. Ralph Klein also cut taxes, both corporate and personal, and one of the policies that his government was most known for was bringing in Alberta's 10% flat income tax. That means that no matter how much money you made in a given year, you would pay 10% flat income tax, whether you made $50,000 a year or $100,000 a year. Ralph Klein was reelected with massive majorities, with his largest being 62% of the popular vote. And for the most of his premiership, there was no meaningful opposition in the Alberta legislature. Now, following the 13 years or so that Ralph Klein was in power, there was obviously going to be some appetite for change going forward. And this resulted in the election of Ed Stelmach, and he was seen in a way as a return to the progressive side of the Progressive Conservative Party that both Peter Lougheed and Don Getty embodied. Now, the Stelmach government increased government spending and instituted a royalty review in 2008, months before the global financial crisis and recession. This shocked and dampened investment in Alberta's oil sector. In 2009, the Stelmach PCs lost a by-election in Calgary-Glenmore to the leader of the then Wild Rose Alliance, Paul Hinman. And prior to this, Calgary-Glenmore, a riding in southern Calgary, was considered to be one of the safest PC seats in the Alberta legislature, and this was a shock to many in the party. As a result of Ed Stelmach's wavering on the oil sector through the royalty review and seeming abandonment of Klein-era tax cutting, red tape reduction, and general shrinkage of government, Ed Stelmach resigned in 2011. And throughout this entire time period, conservatives, grassroots conservatives at least by name, were getting very upset with the way the government was headed. Following Ed Stelmach, we had the election of Alison Redford, and this was a surprise to many with the runoff balloting that the PCs used at the time. Alison Redford effectively came up the middle and won the PC leadership race by courting teachers and unions and ultimately promising to restore education funding that the government had cut. Alison Redford was the biggest red Tory candidate that the Progressive Conservatives had seen. And as a bit of a reminder on what this means, when we say someone is a red Tory, it effectively means that they have a liberal social policy or favor more government spending, but at the same time they aim to also reduce the government budget and expenditures, as well as focusing on growing the economy through traditional conservative means. But, and you know, when we look at this and we look at what Alison Redford did, barring the carbon tax and the general ineptitude of the Alberta NDP, the premiership of Alison Redford and Rachel Notley were remarkably similar. Under Redford, government spending continued to increase and the government was pushing 40 years in office at this point in time and became arrogant and entitled. Redford later resigned in 2014 amid a collection of scandals, including renovating a government office building's top floor to create the so-called Sky Palace that, of course, Thomas Lukaszczyk oversaw as deputy premier, but he won't admit that today, and as well as numerous costly foreign international trips that, prior to Justin Trudeau arriving on the scene, were outright astounding. One of these was an over $40,000 flight to Nelson Mandela's funeral. Alison Redford also used the government fleet of aircraft for non-government business, and this enraged many in the province. And the combined force of Alison Redford and Ed Stelmach was what eventually led to the downfall of the Progressive Conservatives. It was a shock, as we mentioned, when Paul Hinman won the Calgary-Glenmore by-election in 2009, and after this, the Wild Rose recruited then-radio presenter Danielle Smith to become leadership of that party. Three PC MLAs also crossed the floor to join the Wild Rose, making a caucus of four. This was Paul Hinman, Rob Anderson, Heather Forsyth, and Guy Boutillier. It was widely thought that the Wild Rose would win the 2012 election, but the polls failed to capture a late switch back to the PCs after people became concerned with the fact that the Wild Rose might employ some of the cutting tactics that the Klein government used, as well as the so-called Lake of Fire incident that dominated media headlines for days in that campaign. In the 2012 race, the Wild Rose formed opposition with 18 seats. The Wild Rose would be the most effective opposition in Alberta's history, taking down a premier but ultimately destroying itself with a massive floor crossing in December 2014 after the election of Jim Prentice as leader. And as we know and as we have talked about many times before on the podcast, this led to the events of the 2015 election, with the Conservatives upset by Ed Stelmach and the public trust eroded by Alison Redford. The PCs didn't have much left for the 2015 election in terms of supporters, and they won only a handful of seats in Calgary. Wild Rose was also thought to be dead and unable to form government. This resulted in a protest vote to the NDP and a wild vote split that led to Alberta's NDP forming government. The remnants of the PCs and Wild Rose knew that 2015 must not be repeated and formed the United Conservative Party. And this is where we are at today in Alberta conservative history.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the evolution between the social credit dynasty and the progressive conservative dynasty that really shaped all of 80 years of Alberta's history, right from right in the middle of the Great Depression all the way up until just a few years ago. And just to see the different policies that were taking place to prolong that dynasty in government, to turn Alberta from just a simple province that was based on agriculture up into the economic powerhouse that it is today.
And, you know, that is something that most people looking at Alberta don't realize, is that one of the things that led to the success of the Progressive Conservatives was that party changed to reflect the population at the time, and that in the 1970s it became more urban-focused, focused on more government spending and battling the then-federal government of Pierre Trudeau and Brian Mulroney on the National Energy Program and the GST, respectively. And then we had the 1990s to early 2000s era under Ralph Klein, in which people wanted a return to a more conservative type policy. And then the pendulum swung backwards once again, providing Albertans with Ed Stelmach and Alison Renford. And that's one thing that if you look at the Progressive Conservative Party, specifically under Alison Redford, and you compare that to the NDP, and if you take out the carbon tax and, in general, some of the rookie moves that the NDP made, those two governments were very similar. And lots of people, if you took down a bullet point of what the government stood for and what they wanted to do, you would find many similarities there. And this is all, of course, what culminated in the creation of the United Conservative Party. And that's where we are today. So we'll have to see if the United Conservative Party does what the PCs did and change to match what the population is doing, or if they stick to the far conservative side. And at some point in the future, 10, 12 years down the road, the government changes. That will be an interesting thing to watch.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see how the party changes with what the population wants, but then what the party changes to ends up being what the population doesn't want at all. And so it leads to a very interesting match between trying to win elections and also trying to enact your own personal policy. And I think that's something that politicians everywhere have the dilemma about, whether they should do what they think is right or if they do what they think should remain, have them remain in government. And I think when you look at what happened with Ed Stelmach and Alison Redford, certainly they did what they thought the population was wanting, but it turned out that was not the case whatsoever.
Indeed. And one final note on Alberta, it's worth noting that once a government is defeated in Alberta, it typically does not come back. So that's why fast forwarding to the next election here in Alberta, it's going to be interesting to see if the NDP maintains their opposition status or if they disappear, as both the United Farmers did and the Social Credit eventually did. And there are definitely some people in Alberta that would hope that would happen. But I think we can also look one province to the west and compare what Alberta's Social Credit did to conservatism in BC with the Social Credit Party there.
Yeah, that's right. And conservatism in BC is really an amalgamation of many different beliefs. Now, as it stands, BC doesn't really have a truly effective conservative party, as other provinces might term it. And with the election of the CAQ in Quebec, BC stands alone among the provinces without some form of conservative party. Now, in BC, since the recognition of political parties in 1903, for almost 30 years, elections were determined between the Liberals and the Conservatives, as they were in most other provinces. However, in 1933, the BC wing of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, which was the Socialist Party that was the precursor to the NDP, started mobilizing and gaining support in BC elections. Now, the CCF gained more and more vote percentage, and the Liberals and Conservatives actually formed a coalition government after the elections of 1945 and 1949 to keep the CCF out of power. And that's the real basis of Conservatism in BC, in that before 1952, the elections were decided between the Liberals and Conservatives with the intent of blocking the CCF from power. And this early polarization would lead to a dramatic shift of events in 1952. Now, the election of 1952 was the first general election to use a preferential ballot, which was a short-lived phenomenon in BC. The presence of multi-member districts such as Victoria City with three MLAs, in conjunction with the alternative voting system, called for an innovation where the district's slate of candidates was split into three separate ballots, each with one candidate from each party. Now, the system had been designed by the coalition government to enable to the governing Liberal Progressive Conservative Coalition, at that time the Conservatives had recently changed their name to match that of their federal cousins, to keep the Socialist Cooperative Commonwealth Federation out of power. As an added measure to lock out the CCF, the coalition devised an elimination ballot system. While they ran candidates under their own names, the Liberals and Tories believed that if Liberal voters picked a Tory on their second preference and vice versa, the two parties would gain enough votes between them to stay in power. However, the coalition to the CCF voters would do it their second preferences. These votes overwhelmingly flowed to the BC Social Credit League, and combined with the second preference votes from the Liberals and Conservatives, this was actually enough to vault Social Credit to 19 seats, one more than the CCF. Meanwhile, the coalition was decimated, winning only 10 seats between them. Both Premier Byron Boss Johnson and Tory leader Herbert Anscombe actually lost their seats based on this gambit. Now, not even the Socreds had actually expected to win the election. The party had no official leader, though Alberta Social Credit Member of Parliament, Reverend Ernest George Hansel, actually led the party during the election campaign without contesting a seat. The Socreds persuaded Tom Uphill, who was a Labour member of the legislature, to support the party, and so the Socreds were able to form a minority government. Now, the party's next task was then to elect a leader who would become the province's new premier. In a vote of the newly elected caucus, W.A.C. Bennett, who was a former Conservative MLA who joined the Socreds after losing a bid for the Tory leadership, won a caucus vote and became the premier-elect on July 15th of 1952. Now, this would actually begin what would be 21 years and 36 of the next 39 years of Social Credit government in BC. Now, in the hopes of gaining a stronger mandate, Bennett actually deliberately lost a confidence vote, which forced fresh elections in June 1953, at which the Social Credit actually won a majority in its own right. Now, W.A.C. Bennett, who close friends and enemies alike referred to as Wacky Bennett, was an interesting character, and probably BC's best premier as well as the longest serving. While the Social Credit Party was founded to promote the social credit theories of monetary reform, this could not be implemented at the provincial level, as the Alberta Social Credit Party had learned in the 1930s. Bennett quickly converted the BC Social Credit Party into a populist conservative party instead, and it became a vehicle for those who sought to keep the CCF out of power. So this trend of the polarization between the CCF and the non-CCF parties ended up continuing. Now, the cabinets of the Bennett governments over 20 years had several memorable ministers, including the flamboyant Flying Phil Gagliardi, who oversaw the rapid expansion of highways throughout the province and a similar expansion of BC ferries, as well as government aircraft. He was a very strong proponent of buying a Learjet for government use, which led to his nickname of Flying Phil. Now, his term was marked by rapid expansion of the province's paved road system, as well as the completion of some of the most major road bridges in BC. Bennett actually described the building program as the greatest highway building program per capita in the Western world. Now, W.A.C. Bennett was a staunch fiscal conservative, and he actually also served as the Minister of Finance under his own government, which kept a tight control over government spending while leading his province into an era of modernization and prosperity. His practice of pay-as-you-go carefully tracked spending, transferred debts to other government agencies, which allowed Bennett in 1959 to actually claim that the province was debt-free. In the early years of the social credit government spurred on vast amounts of capital investment, large amounts of infrastructure building, and carefully managing the province's finances to turn our beautiful province into an economic powerhouse. During his years as premier, the population of BC actually more than doubled. Now, this all came crashing to an end in 1972. Young NDP leader Dave Barrett benefited from his youth and charisma, allowing the media to contrast him with the aged Bennett, and he ran a campaign focused on people issues such as urban transit, public auto insurance, and increased royalties from the province's timber and mineral industries. Late in the campaign, Bennett declared at a social credit rally that the socialist hordes are at the gates of British Columbia. Now, although Bennett's campaign had been lackluster, no commenters actually anticipated the party's loss, and we'll see this to be repeated in history later on in Alberta, of course. Now, the resulting NDP majority came as a huge surprise. A terrible social credit campaign, as well as 20 years in power, led to voters looking for change, and the NDP under Barrett was elected to a majority. W.A.C. Bennett resigned as leader, and the party looked for change from within. Bill Bennett, who was Wacky's son, actually won election in 1975, which barred the NDP from power again for another 16 years. Now, until 1991, elections in BC were polarized between the Socreds and the NDP, with both getting around the mid to high 40s in vote percentage, with the Socreds just staying ahead. The contrasting social democratic and fiscal conservative programs of both parties led to some bitter campaigns. Bill Van Der Zandt, who took over leadership of the party from the retiring Bill Bennett in 1986, was involved in a conflict of interest scandal that tarnished both his and his party's reputations. Moderate Socred voters fled to the renewed BC Liberal Party under Gordon Wilson, and the Grand Coalition against the NDP was broken, which led to 10 years of NDP rule in BC. Now, the BC Liberal Party, which from 1987 onward was actually independent of the federal Liberals, realized that with the demise of social credit, that the only way to defeat the NDP was to coalesce into a Big Ten party, attracting both moderate Liberals as well as conservative voters. Now, the NDP of the 90s largely held a social democratic policy, as is the name. Premier Mike Harcourt's first years included increases in welfare spending and rates, and although low in the polls for much of his term in office, Harcourt and his newly appointed Attorney General, Ujjal Dosanjh, succeeded in regaining substantial public support by taking a hard line against a fringe Aboriginal group's occupation of a farmer's field in the Cariboo region of the province. The Gustafan Lake Siege, as it was known, was led by Dosanjh and became the largest-scale police operation in BC history, in which armored vehicles provided by the Canadian military were used by the RCMP for protection. The military strongly rejected attempts by the RCMP to have them take over control of the situation, and ultimately it remained a police operation. Anti-vehicle mines were deployed and thousands of rounds of ammunition were shot at First Nations protesters. And this led to Harcourt being much higher in the polls than he was for much of his term in office. However, less than 72 hours before a planned election call, with the BC NDP riding high in the polls for its hard line against both welfare recipients and Aboriginal and environmental radicals, the party's provincial office was raided by RCMP officers as part of an ongoing investigation of illegal use of charity bingo money. And this was coined Bingogate by the media, by former provincial cabinet minister and member of parliament Dave Stupich. Now, although Harcourt wasn't actually implicated in either the raid or the probe, And he was later fully exonerated. He resigned nevertheless, and the party was led into the 1996 provincial election by Glenn Clark. Now, during these years, the BC NDP began to bleed support and activists to the BC Greens, who reached 5% in the polls in the fall of 1997 and 11% by the fall of 1998. However, by far the majority of the BC NDP's former voters deserted the party for the BC Liberals. New scandals had also surfaced, this time appearing to implicate Clark in using his influence to win a casino license for a neighbor who had helped him with some home renovation. Now, another blunder was the botched construction of the Pacific Cab BC Ferries, which would later become part of the Fast Ferry scandal. The project, which was designed to speed transportation between Vancouver and Nanaimo, was plagued by cost overruns and poor technical decisions. By mid-1999, an obvious rift had appeared in the administration, as Attorney General Dosange and Finance Minister Joy McPhail challenged Glenn Clark's legitimacy. Now, the party and province endured a few chaotic months of government with frequent cabinet shuffles following a police raid on Glenn Clark's home before the premier finally stepped aside. Now, in the ensuing 2001 election, the BC Liberals obliterated the NDP. They won an astounding 77 of 79 seats and reduced the NDP to just 2 seats. It was also the second worst defeat of a sitting provincial government in Canada, eclipsed only by the New Brunswick election of 1987. Now, Gordon Cambo, who at the time led to the BC Liberals and became premier, may have been a BC Liberal, but at heart he was a conservative. Campbell introduced a 25% cut in all provincial income taxes on the first day that he was installed to office. To improve BC's investment climate, the BC Liberals also reduced the corporate income tax rate and abolished the corporate capital tax for most businesses. This was a tax on investment and employment that had been introduced by the NDP. Now, Campbell's first term was also noted for his fiscal austerity, which included reductions in welfare rolls and some social services, deregulation, cutting of red tape, and the sale of underperforming government assets like BC Rail and the aforementioned Fast Ferries. Now, Campbell's policies and investment led to a period of economic growth for BC, with investment in the province skyrocketing. The Liberals were re-elected in the 2005 election with a reduced majority of 46 to 33, and the Liberals were again re-elected in the 2009 election with similar numbers. Now, however, after this 2009 election, there was the Campbell government decided to introduce the HST, or Harmonized Sales Tax, and this was announced contrary to promises made during the election campaign. Now, on November 3rd, 2010, Gordon Campbell was facing an imminent caucus revolt over his management style and the political backlash against the HST, and with his approval rating as low as 9% in the polls, Campbell announced his resignation. Now, the approval of the petition to recall the HST in British Columbia paved the way for a referendum that allowed BC to decide the fate of the tax system. Elections BC conducted the referendum via mail-in ballot, allowing registered voters to send in their decisions in regards to the HST. And at the end of the day, the referendum was conducted in the summer of 2011. In an attempt to appease public anger, the government pledged that the referendum would be binding and that they would abide by the will of the people. The referendum passed, and with over 54% voting to abolish the HST, Campbell's gambit had failed. Now, Campbell's resignation and his more centrist successor Christy Clark's leadership election in 2011 effectively ended conservatism's representation in BC. The BC Liberals drifted more to the center, and after Clark's election loss, in quotation marks, in 2017, which we've talked about before, we have yet to see the BC Liberals drift back from the center. And we'll have to see how new opposition leader Andrew Wilkinson drives the party and how the next election will go.
And there's a saying in conservative circles in Canada that if a conservative party, whether it be a progressive conservative party or even people like the Wild Rose, or as we have here, the BC Liberals, run as a liberal or a centrist party, they're going to bleed support. And as we saw here, that's what happened with Christy Clark. And, you know, what is absolutely astounding with comparing Alberta and BC is that both provinces have similar trajectories up to a point, and then ultimately things change. And another thing we need to mention that we talked about on the show just a few weeks back is that if you look at what the NDP government was up to in BC in the 1990s, money laundering was happening. And that's exactly what we have been talking about these past few weeks, that this is still going on. And it's just now that finally a public inquiry to money laundering in BC has been called. And, you know, it's good that the NDP government of today did that. But in comparing where the past NDP government in BC was and how they suffered that disastrous defeat, and you effectively have a big tent coalition running BC, whether it's under the Liberals or the Social Credit, that's similar to what we had with the Progressive Conservatives. And it's a shame to see that there is no actual Conservative Party in BC that can garner votes, and to see where that would go in the modern era with the success of the UCP and the Doug Ford PCs in Ontario. But given, I assume, the stronger NDP base, the reason for that is that there is the need for a central coalescence behind one big tent center-right centrist party in BC.
Yeah, that's right. And I think a lot of people don't realize, especially around my age, don't realize just how bad the NDP governments of the 90s were in BC. They took a period of growth under the Social Credit and they dialed it back. They increased spending by large amounts. And there was all these scandals that happened. They could not stay in government without all these scandals coming to light. You know, the conflict of interest under the Premier Glenn Clark, the Fast Ferry scandal, the spending scandals that happened. And that was just the tip of the iceberg at the time. If we had known about money laundering at the time, I'm sure that maybe they would have lost the last two seats that they lost in 2001 as well, because that was such a huge landslide. People overwhelmingly wanted change. And it's only just recently that they decided that they wanted to go back to that.
Yeah, and you know, I think the history will speak for itself when the next BC election happens. If John Horgan does get a majority government at that point, and there is of course the check on power currently right now, that if the BC minority NDP does anything that is too off the rails or perhaps ethically shady, the Green Party can pull the plug. And as to whether or not Andrew Wilkinson can pick up the pieces and reassemble that center-right coalition that used to be the BC Liberals and the Social Credit, that'll probably be a future episode of Western Context to look into. But nonetheless, a very interesting history in BC and how the trajectories at up to a point in the early histories of the provinces were the same for both BC and Alberta. It is important to note that the Social Credit Party of BC was far less on the social conservative side than in Alberta, and I think that is also something that many in BC probably don't realize, and also those in Alberta don't realize as well if they didn't look into the BC Social Credit.
Yeah, that's true. Most conservative parties in BC, as they ran mostly socially centrist, you could say. A lot of the times, most of the policy was based on fiscal conservatism and economic growth through that. And not much of the care was based on social conservatism, and that was the main difference between it, the BC Social Credit Party, and its Alberta cousins, in which the Alberta Social Credit were focused much more on social conservatism, where BC kind of made its own path. We made our own West Coast blend of conservatism, but we don't really have that much of that anymore, and we'll have to see how it goes in future elections for sure.
Indeed. And speaking of the Social Credit Party in Alberta, I mentioned you want to remember the name Manning. And what we're going to do now is have a look at how conservatism in Canada, and especially the last two or three decades, has been defined by a Western Canadian slant. And to begin this, we start off with Preston Manning and the Reform Party. The Reform Party was formed in the late 1980s. This was due to discontent with the Mulroney PCs and them not fixing what was effectively seen as major missteps by the then Trudeau liberals of the early 1980s and 70s, dealing with the National Energy Program and, of course, the GST and the focus on Quebec. All of this culminated into the formation of the Reform Party of Canada, led by Preston Manning. The party elected its first MP in 1989, Deborah Gray, in her Edmonton North seat, and the party would go on to elect 52 MPs in 1993, almost capturing official opposition status, but the Bloc Québécois got 54 seats in 93, forming the official opposition. And this was also the election federally where the Progressive Conservatives, that institution that goes back to the very founding of Canada, as we talked about last year, the first Prime Minister, John A. Macdonald, being a part of the Progressive Conservatives, or the then Conservative Party, won only two seats in 1993. And this was all possible under the leadership of Preston Manning, who is the son of former Alberta Social Credit Premier Ernest Manning. The Reform Party was one that was based on Western populism. They had a simple platform of fiscal conservatism, grassroots democracy. That is, rather than having a party executive up at the top define policy, it would be defined in policy meetings at the riding level. And of course, Senate reform following the constitutional issues of the 1980s. But most importantly, the slogan was that the West wanted in on the decision-making process of the federal government, seeing as we mentioned at the time, both BC and Alberta were rising in terms of their economic power and wanted to have more say in national affairs. The party also had a social conservative leaning in that it opposed gay marriage at the time, and it also suggested a potential return to capital punishment should it win one of the elections in the 1990s. The Reform, like the Canadian Alliance and its Alberta equivalent, the Wild Rose, was an effective opposition. It was so effective that through the 1990s, there was a reliable vote split between the Reform Party and the Progressive Conservatives, resulting in subsequent liberal majorities for Jean Chrétien. The Reform Party formed official opposition in 97, winning 60 seats and 19% of the vote. And that same year, the Progressive Conservatives under Jean Charest took 18% of the vote and 20 seats. And this, of course, tallies up to 37% of the vote, give or take, on the Conservative side, with 41% for Chrétien's Liberals in 1997. And this was reason enough to start thinking about unity and whether or not the Reform Party could actually form a government on its own. And keep in mind that if you're listening from Eastern Canada, that the Reform Party was founded as a Western-based protest party. And as a result of this, it was thought that maybe they might need to do a bit of a rebrand in order to win seats in Ontario and the rest of the country.
Yeah, and I think that's something that a lot of people in Eastern Canada wouldn't really know that much about in regards to the Reform Party, is that it was very much Western populist based, in that a lot of people in the West didn't see the federal government as representing them, and there was a huge amount of Western alienation, specifically under Pierre Elliott Trudeau and his national energy policy, where it was seen that the central Canadian provinces of Ontario and Quebec were stealing from the Western provinces, stealing money, stealing their energy, stealing growth and the economy. And a lot of it came down to a dissatisfaction with how the Eastern-based leaders of the parties were representing the West. And that's why I think a lot of it was started by Preston Manning, because he wanted to have more say for the West in federal politics. And as we saw, the Reform Party ended up gaining more and more support, specifically in Western Canada, and provided a very large opposition. But the strength of the Liberal Party federally meant that the Reform Party wasn't able to become government. And as you said, they did need to coalesce into a larger conservative Party, and that led to what happened in 2000.
Yeah, and that of course is the founding of the Canadian Alliance Party. The original name of this party was going to be the Conservative Reform Alliance Party, and you know that was abbreviated to CRAP. So I think many in the media and people reading the party literature are very happy that they did go with Canadian Alliance. And this was an attempt to rebrand the party and gain a following out east and in central Canada, attempting to form a government on that front. And when the party was formed, Stockwell Day and Preston Manning both ran for leadership of the new party, and Manning was defeated in that. It was felt that at the time, people wanted a younger face on the party and a different change of pace from what reform had meant. And it worked to a degree. The party gained 25% of the vote in the 2000 election, garnering them 66 seats. And at the same time, though, the PCs won 12% of the popular vote and gained 12 seats. And here we have it again, 37% of the popular vote on the conservative side, but no government. And unity was needed at this point in time. And fast forward to early 2001, there were caucus troubles, including resignations and a question about the future of the party that ultimately led to the resignation of Stockwell Day and his attempt to effectively clear the slate by calling for a new leadership election. And in this leadership of election, this was the election in which Stockwell Day ran against Stephen Harper. Stephen Harper won with 55% of the vote, and this was, of course, the keys that were needed to move this party into closer relations with the Progressive Conservatives, because at the time we had Peter MacKay leading the Progressive Conservatives and Stephen Harper leading the Alliance, and it was announced in October of 2003 that the Conservative Party of Canada would be created. The idea to merge the parties was ratified on December 5th, 2003, and on March 20th of 2004, Stephen Harper became leader of the Conservative Party of Canada.
Yeah, it was really interesting to see how Stephen Harper was able to win the leadership election of the Canadian Alliance and then coalesce the parties together, in that all of the major Conservative parties in Canada were then going to be under one banner, which would then fight against the Jean Chrétien-led Liberals, or as it was after that, the Paul Martin Liberals, and how the two prevailing policies would then be able to go against each other, with the possibility of the Conservatives winning government, and the fact that the new Conservative Party of Canada was led by the old roots of the Western Reform-based party meant that Western Canada would have a voice.
And this voice is something that, if you look at the uprising of the Reform Party, you see very key figures. Obviously, you have Preston Manning, but of course, Stephen Harper was around in the Reform Party, and there's also someone else who's notable that was around since the early days of the Reform Party, and that is, of course, current Premier Jason Kenney. So this is a return to what effectively amounts to conservatism, Western-based conservatism in Canada, and this formed a government first in 2006, but before that it actually formed a strong official opposition in 2004, winning 99 of 308 seats, and once again 37% of the vote, knocking Paul Martin's Liberals down to a minority government. And that's all it took to shatter 12, 13 years of Liberal rule was a united Conservative Party at the federal level. This minority government, elected in 2004, lasted until late 2005, when it collapsed under a confidence vote, resulting in Canada's first Conservative government since the Brian Mulroney Progressive Conservatives. And on January 23rd of 2006, Stephen Harper won 124 of 308 seats and would kick off almost 10 years of Conservative government in Canada, with two minority mandates, the other one, of course, coming in 2008, bringing him up to, I believe, 143 seats, and one majority mandate in 2011 with 166 seats. And of course, as Prime Minister, Stephen Harper would oversee the continuation of the war in Afghanistan and guiding Canada through the worst recession since the Great Depression. And this is something that was a pivotal moment in Canadian conservatism, is that keep in mind that in 2008, when the recession hit, the election of 2008 had just happened, because it was deemed at that point that the situation in Parliament became toxic or untenable, and Stephen Harper pulled the plug on his own minority majority government getting a larger mandate. But at the same time, there was an attempt by the Liberals, the NDP, and the Bloc Québécois to form a coalition government in the midst of the 2008 financial crisis. And this resulted in many long nights of media coverage and televised addresses from both Stephen Harper and Stéphane Dion on the matter. And it was ultimately decided that Stephen Harper would prorogue the parliament at the time, effectively shutting it down, pulling the plug, and coming back for a fresh start in 2009 in order to deal with the recession. And the governor general at the time, Michael Jean, agreed to this, preserving the conservative minority government, and effectively allowed this government to live until 2011, in which it was reelected with a majority. And this is what we saw as a result of this recession. The policies of this government focused on careful stewardship of the economy, not to increase the debt or deficit too much, except for in needs of that huge stimulus following the recession, tax credits for families and in general, a hands-off approach in dealing with the provinces, which we hadn't seen for a long time and which we're seeing an abandonment of now, which is in large part causing the perceived national unity crisis that is happening in Canada today. And during Stephen Harper's time in government, there was no unity crisis. Quebec was happy. The West was happy. Ontario was happy. The Atlantic provinces were happy too. And throughout all this, we also had a robust foreign policy where Canada stood up for its values abroad rather than being the honest broker or neutral third party that we had been for decades. And then this takes us to the 2015 election and the defeat of the Conservatives. And that, of course, then led to the election of Andrew Scheer as Conservative leader. And he is, of course, from Saskatchewan. And what we've seen in the past 4 years and what we have been talking about on this podcast, Canadians are going to have a very clear choice when the fall election comes, whether it be more of Justin Trudeau or a return to this Western-based conservatism under Andrew Scheer.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the stewardship of Stephen Harper through the Great Recession, I think, should not be understated, because almost alone of his policies of all of the Western-based governments, the U.S., of course, was the main recipient of the huge recession with the housing market crash. The UK had lots of economic troubles. Almost the entire Western world was plunged into economic recession. But Canada alone was able to actually stay afloat and not have too much trouble with the economic recession out of all of the others. And we're able to keep afloat, keep balances positive, can keep investment flowing in, which I think was really really a strong pillar of how the economic policy of Harper was able to guide Canada through up until 2015.
And looking at that entire policy, it's been long said that there were people who were effectively policy-based conservatives who would fight for a fiscal policy of conservatism and no budgetary stimulus at all costs. And it was long said that it was Stephen Harper at the time in 2008 who drove the decision with then Finance Minister Jim Flaherty to run the stimulus campaign. And in some ways they needed to politically because of the minority government situation. But at the same time, Stephen Harper has become known as one of the politicians that isn't necessarily going to push policy for the sake of pushing policy. It gets pushed because it's the right decision for the right time. And this is something that he's even been active about since leaving office when it comes to the populist push that we've seen in the recent years with Donald Trump and Brexit, just to name a couple of things. So when it comes to the former conservative government under Stephen Harper, it was a direction that provided Canada to be in a good place. And that just factors into the decision that many Canadians will be making this fall in the federal election.
Yeah, that's true. And now that the Conservatives are being led by Andrew Scheer, they still have a very strong official opposition. It's not like they were decimated in the election of 2015. That just coalesced in a amalgamation of the NDP collapse plus the Liberals' rise under Trudeau to mean that Trudeau and the Liberals benefited from a lot of the NDP vote share that they had gained in the 2011 election. And a lot of people voted against Harper, in the sense a lot of people on the left and the center left voted against Harper, and they all went for the Liberals. So in the next election that's going to be happening this fall, we are going to see whether that situation is going to be reversed and if people coalesce under Andrew Scheer to vote against Justin Trudeau. And as we've said a few times on the podcast before, governments usually aren't elected, they're usually voted out.
Indeed, and this is a culmination of Western-based conservatism. And BC has its own history, Alberta has its own history, and what we've seen in the recent years is, of course, a story on the federal level with the birth of the Reform Party and the ultimate formation of the Conservative Party of Canada and it forming government. And we had the similar trend in Alberta too. And the lesson that everybody should take from this is that in terms of history of Canada in general, is that when you're looking at the media, when you're looking at current events, and this ties into what we do here on the podcast, you need to have the knowledge and the information of that history to put the news in context of what's happening today. And that's what we do here at Western Context, hence the name of the show. So that is why from time to time we'll do these history-based specials, because it just serves to inform the listeners' opinions and beliefs about the way things are currently happening and how we got to the point where we're at. And effectively, we'd like to think helping everybody make better decisions when it comes time to make those decisions in whether it be a provincial or federal election.
Yeah, that's right. And we see in the provinces as well as federally that history does tend to repeat itself in the ebb and flow of governments, how certain premiers rise up, or prime ministers even, how they form governments, how they rise up and then they fall. It all is very cyclical, and I think people need to look at what's happened in the past to know what's going to happen in the future. And I think, as we've said before, in the fall, we're going to have two very clear choices as to what kind of government that we want to have, whether we want to have that Western-based Canadian Conservative Party that is still very much Canadian Conservative and very much Western-based, or if we're going to have more of the globalist style of rule from Eastern Canada that the Trudeau Liberals espouse.
Indeed, and I think that's a good point where we can leave this show, and we'll be back next week with regularly scheduled episodes of Western Context. But in the meantime, if you want full show notes, you can find those at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Pocket Cast, or any other podcast listener out there, westerncontext.ca/subscribe for information on how to do that. And you can, of course, follow us on social media at Western Context, where we post stories and news throughout the entirety of the week. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.
And as we get back into our regular episodes, we will always make sure to look through all the stories that the media talks about and some that they don't talk about, to cut through all that bias and sensationalism that they always display, no matter what it is, in news, in TV, in print, in online, to make sure that you have the context needed to put yourself on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.